This is an ABC podcast.
This is Blueprint for Living. I'm Jonathan Green. Time for Lost and Found. And this week, Earth. Professor Stefan Mattei is Chair of Reservoir Engineering in the Department of Infrastructure Engineering at the University of Melbourne. Stefan, I wonder how much does the nature of cities that we see above the earth depend on the earth that's beneath them?
Yeah, it does depend to a great deal on the subsurface. And if you take, for instance, Manhattan Island, it's the prototype of the best building site that you can imagine. These are sort of very strong rocks from a great depth in the crust, rocks that have been metamorphosed, that have been glaciated. They are almost as strong as steel as their compressive strength is concerned. And that's perhaps why the first big skyscraper building projects were so successful on Manhattan Island.
How close do the foundations of those skyscrapers come to that very solid rock?
Oh, they go into the solid rock. And I guess this is probably true for any heavier building, that you need to go through the soil and you need to go into the solid rock beneath. Now, having said that, if we think, for instance, about the Burj Al Khalifa in Dubai, which is the world's tallest building that stands taller than 800 meters, I mean, there you have a mixture of soils and sedimentary rocks. So there are three groups of rocks, sedimentary rocks, which are basically indurated layers of soil. Now, they become rocks through chemical processes. The second group are volcanic and igneous rocks. So this is lava that either poured out on the Earth's surface or crystallized at depth. And the third group are metamorphic rocks, so rocks that have been heated up to 400, 500, 600 degrees, compressed at very great pressures, and again, they become very solid rocks.
What's the relationship between the height of a building and the depth of its footing? Is it sort of like an inverted iceberg?
No, it isn't. I mean, the Burj Al Khalifa, for instance, is over 800 meters tall, and the tallest piles it sits on are 50 meters deep. So in a way, when you drive these piles in, that depends, of course, on the nature of the subsurface. So if you think of a rock as a porous medium, like a piece of feta cheese or something that has pores in it, or let's say a cookie, then at some point, you know, you push the point load on a cookie and you crack into it. This is true for rocks, sandstones, any porous rocks in particular. When you're doing this piling, you want to avoid that you reach that point so that the load, so you basically want to distribute the load such that it's in contact with these subsurface layers that the pile goes through and doesn't slip relative to them as you're loading it. And it's not just pressing down, but it's also sometimes pulling, because if the wind pushes against the building, one side may be pushing down and the other side might be pulling up.
In Australian cities, there must be great regional variation from Sydney to Melbourne, from Melbourne to Adelaide.
Absolutely. And I mean, Melbourne is a wonderful example, because in the east, you have the metamorphic rocks from the Lachlan Fold Belt. You may have seen this driving on the highways. I think it's the M3, where you see these wonderful road cuts. And if you watch a little bit more closely, you see some fold structures and you see some sort of puff pastry-like foliation in these rocks. So these are metamorphic rocks, 100 million years old. Then you have the bluestones. They are much more recent rocks, but they are intercalated with young sedimentary rocks of the Port Phillip Bay. And there you have very big contrast, you know, the strong bluestones, but they're thin layers, just a few meters thick typically. Then you get some soft sediments. Then laterally, you may have sand from the Yarra River and all kinds of other Yarra River sediments that are shed into the bay, which are really, really soft, have a porosity of 40%, so almost half the rock is water-filled space. And of course, if you push down on those, they will just squeeze laterally or compact very dramatically.
Sydney is notable for its sandstone, which I imagine is a useful construction material above the ground, but perhaps not optimal below the ground in the earth?
Oh, Sydney is in a very good position. I mean, these sandstones are very, very strong. You know, they have been buried fairly deeply. They've been heated up. And you can think of sandstones in, they come in basically three varieties. One that consists of quartz grains and they're stuck together by quartz cement. The second one is quartz grains stuck together by carbonate cement. Very little of that exists in Australia because there's not many carbonates. And the third kind, where you have the sand grains stuck together by clay. And that's, of course, the weakest variety. So Sydney sits on sandstones that consist of quartz, are bonded together by quartz. Okay, there's other minerals in there, but they're very, very strong. They're almost as strong as the bluestone.
Stefan, thank you so much.
You are welcome.
Professor Stefan Mattei. Clive Blasey is founder of the Diggers Club. Clive, when I think Earth, my mind turns to the things that grow within us, but perhaps entirely within it. I'm thinking beetroot, Clive.
That's an interesting subject.
Take us back to the origin of that beet.
Yeah, well, I was travelling around France about 3 or 4 years ago, and I was walking along a beach, and I came across the original species of what is now either silver beet or beetroot. It's Beta vulgaris, in other words, the common beet. So when you see that growing, it doesn't look anything like the beetroot that we eat.
What does it look like?
Well, it's still got the leaves that you find on a beetroot, obviously, but it looks nothing like a silver beet, and it's a pretty ordinary root, actually, so it doesn't look like a big, thick, swollen thing that we rely on underground.
The trick is that from that comes both silver beet and beetroot.
Yeah, so people have selected it for two forms. They've taken the varieties and extended the leaf so that you get the silver beet part. And we've actually done some work recently too. And there's five colours in beetroot, almost the same as there are different colours in carrots. And so silver beet expresses itself. We sell a silver beet called five colour beet. We get roughly five colours in the stems, and we usually get dark green or blacky coloured leaves, which are the silver beet that mother always used to serve in the evenings. It is in fact exactly the same plant that has been selected for the root crop. And the ancient variety is a pretty tiny little beet that you wouldn't have a second look at, but the ones that we all grow for beetroot, and the one that's canned, which is the purple variety, which is a large bulb, I don't know, is 10 or 20 times the size of the original species. But we've selected out or managed to find yellow beets, orange beets, white beets. There's one that looks like the rings of an onion, which comes from Italy, as well as the sort of ordinary one that is canned, and that's what we used to eat a long time ago.
They're characteristic, that sort of earthiness of flavour in them. How does that happen?
Well, that's a mystery to me. Of course, some chefs would want to remove it because it's too earthy. Doesn't make it a classy vegetable, but the leaves above the root crop look rather like the original. So, you know, they're not very extended or anything like a silver beet, but they're still edible varieties, and that's served in salads as a ready to eat.
The story of the beetroot and of silver beet, closely related. Thank you, Clive.
Thank you.
My name is Wayne Crothers, Senior Curator of Asian Art at the NGV, and welcome to our recent Winter Masterpieces exhibition. Terracotta Warriors, Guardians of Immortality, and Sai Guo Chun, Transient Landscape.
There's so much here, so many objects of different types. But it struck us walking through that there's a commonality here in origin, a sort of an earthly presence about all the things that make these things that we see around us.
Well, interestingly, the historical objects in the show cover a period of 1,200 years, from 1,000 BC to 200 AD, and exclusively they're all made from either bronze, jade, gold, or ceramics. And then the contemporary works, which were produced by the contemporary artist Ai Gua Chan, feature the use of gunpowder, which of course is from natural minerals, elements, and porcelain, which is drawn from the earth as well.
The stars of the show, of course, in terracotta, that most earthly of materials, and one that's incredibly long-lasting, incredibly survivable.
Well, yeah, it is survival, but it's also interesting to note that all of the warriors that have been discovered and the others that are speculated to exist, because only 2,000 of the speculated 8,000 have been unearthed, have all been smashed and been reconstructed since their discovery.
So when they were found, and again underground, the condition?
They're all in pieces, and when you look closely, you can see where all the mends have been made. It's speculated that they were smashed just 3 or 4 or 5 years after they were created, during an uprising that eventually put an end to the Qin dynasty, who were the creators of the warriors. So it's been sort of like a not only the discovery, but an incredible sort of project of putting them back together.
Can you see the join?
Yes, you can see the join. The joins are made from the earth, from sort of natural materials as well. You can see where they've all been pieced back together.
What an extraordinary piece of work, too, to locate all the pieces, to organise those. I mean, that's a significant piece of archaeological work.
One of the other incredible mysteries of the whole story of the Terracotta Warriors is that they were created by the first unifying emperor of China, Qin Shi Huang, when he came to power in 221 BC. And then, of course, they were put into their position in these underground trenches at his death in 209 BC. And then they were completely forgotten. There was no record of their existence. And after they were destroyed by the uprising, by the Han, who formed the Han dynasty, which followed the Qin dynasty, they became completely lost until 1974, when a group of farmers in the district, 1.5 kilometres to the east of the first emperor's tomb, were digging an irrigation well to seek water for their persimmon orchard, discovered the first fragments. And from that time, they've been gradually unearthed.
I think you need to introduce me to one of them.
Let's go and have a look. So, descending in rank, start with the generals, who are, people say the warriors are life-size, but in fact, standing here, they're larger than life, especially the generals. They're approximately 197 centimetres tall, very imposing, broad shoulders, representing their rank. They're intentionally imposing when you stand in front of them. Middle-aged, and also better fed than the other members of the army, because they're developing the middle-aged paunch, as you'll see. We have one armoured, one armour, unarmoured. The second row, we move on to infantrymen, who have a slightly more sort of subservient sort of stance.
They're hollow, I assume.
They are hollow. They'd be awfully heavy if they weren't. They're actually made from, in 7 different parts, from the base and made in moulds. The base is made in the square mould, then the legs made in sort of like the same system as a piping would be made. The body made from a coil pot sort of system that everyone would remember from primary school days.
Indeed.
The arms again from moulds, the hands from moulds, manipulated. The positions of the arms and hands are manipulated while the clay was still wet. The general head shape made from a mould, but then the additional clay pieces added, almost like a theatre makeup artist would add sort of strength in the brows or the nose or the chin, or hairstyling, a hairstyle moustache on an actor just about to go on stage.
What do we know about the source of that clay? Do we know where it's from?
Well, there's so many mysteries about the story of the warriors, in that they were completely unknown. Their history was never recorded. When they were discovered, it was a complete surprise. To date, no kilns have been discovered where they were fired. And it's speculated that the clay comes from the same region.
Do you have a favourite?
My favourite?
Mm.
Oh, we'll have to walk a bit further down and we'll come to the standing archer, which is in a very dramatic pose. You'll see him with his front arm sort of forward, his other arm pulled back, His hands are in a position where they've just released the arrow from the bow. The bow and, of course, the arrow have all disintegrated, made from wood. But his stance really has this feeling of tension, as if you can really feel that he's released the arrow. His eyes are looking off into the distance, into the sky, following the trajectory of the arrow as it's flown away into the distance. And for me, he's the most animated and dramatic of all of the poses.
Thank you so very much.
You're welcome.
Lost and Found on Blueprint for Living this week on Earth. Richard Thomas is Managing Director of Worm Lovers. Richard, tell us about the importance to our planet of healthy soil.
Yes, well, Jonathan, when you think about it, pretty much everything, all life on Earth really comes from the soil. You either plants are obviously dependent on healthy soil, and then all so-called higher animals such as us, dependent on plants. So in a way, we're absolutely critically dependent on really what is on average, you know, 3 or 4 inches of topsoil around the planet, fertile soil, that is. Yeah, so it's pretty important. Well, and it has an impact on food production, climate, water reticulation and so forth, and nutrient cycling on many levels.
That in turn means that we are utterly dependent on the good, kind and sacrificing work of the earthworm.
The earthworm is part of a very complex and interesting soil food web ecosystem. And I guess the worm is I guess you could describe as the keystone species of the soil ecology. And so it has a very significant role in promoting all the other critters that live in the soil, particularly all the soil microbes and soil fungi, and have a really important role in cycling nutrients through the soil back into plant available forms that plants can use. So really, really important. And they're like the canary in the coal mine, really, because where you find an abundance of earthworms, you will have very, very healthy, productive soil. And where there is very few or no worms, you generally have much more depleted soil quality.
There is no more heartening sight in nature, Richard, than lifting the top of your compost bin and seeing those worms going hammer and tongs.
That's right, Jonathan. They are really fascinating creatures. They've evolved over hundreds of millions of years in symbiosis with plants. And so Charles Darwin, in fact, spent about 30 years studying earthworms and wrote a book, which he actually considered to be his most important, studying the life cycle of earthworms. And over a period of time, he estimated just by observing the fields that he was studying in Victorian England, tens of thousands of tons of organic matter being moved over through the years by worms, and observed that the way that they created tunnels through the soil, so that pathways for air and water to travel, and observed the way that they break down organic matter, plant organic matter, and turn it back into what he called humus to release those nutrients back to plants. So it's a wonderful example of a natural cycle, and you know, all nature works on these incredible cycles of cycling nutrients and things like carbon, water, nitrogen, and really worms are a key part of that whole process.
Beautiful processes that, of course, humanity is doing its best to disturb. Yeah, you're a tremendous advocate of two things, of worm farms, of composting, and of the effect that they might have at this difficult time for the Earth's ecosystems.
That's right, Jonathan. And I think it's really a critical and often underestimated contribution that composting and worm farming can make to these larger problems that we face. And as you mentioned, we're facing a pretty grim future with not just climate change, but water scarcity, food decline, food production decline, and you know, soil fertility. So we're losing a lot of arable soil. But the good news is we can turn it around really quickly by increasing our use of composting and other ways to get organic matter back into the soil. It's actually been estimated by I think a report came out from the United Nations, that if we were to return globally soils to about 0.4% of organic matter in soils, that would actually stabilise the climate. So one thing that's really interesting in terms of climate change is that about 3/4 of the carbon in the carbon cycle is actually stored in the soils. three times as much carbon stored in the soils than in the atmosphere. So if we can increase our soil fertility and increase that cycling capacity through these vast networks of microbes and fungi and worms and create better soil, we can actually draw down huge amounts of carbon, potentially even more per hectare than you would do by trees occupying the same space. So really, really important. And then there's these other benefits as well, which is soil that's got a lot of humus and worms and worm castings in it can hold up to three times its own weight in water. So that's a really important part of it. Not only that, but obviously you increase your yields and also your resilience to your crops that are grown in more organically stable and biologically active soils. It's really important.
Richard, thank you so very much.
No problem. Great to talk to you.
Richard Thomas. Clive Blasey is a founder of the Diggers Club. Clive, tell me of the symphony of colour that is the carrot.
Well, the original carrot is not orange. In fact, the orange carrot was selected out by the Dutch royal family of that name. The orange, I guess they're monarchs.
What an act of regal vanity that is.
It is, isn't it? So the original carrot came from Afghanistan, and it had purple skin, a little bit of yellow core, maybe orange core, and then a yellow on the inside. So you actually get three colours, and we managed to track that down and list it. The Dutch, I guess, as great horticulturalists, started selecting out the varieties for tenderness, and the orange obviously looks more appealing on the plate than a purple. We've been interested in rescuing these old varieties, and they're now all available, and you can actually buy them in the supermarkets.
Well, what's the variation in taste? Is that in any way related to colour?
Well, I imagine it is, but most of us are trying to get carrots that are tender, and there's not much variation, I don't think, in the flavour particularly. And it's all about plate appeal these days. If you've got five different colours in carrots, it looks pretty good in a top restaurant.
These vegetables that grow down in the earth like that, pushing aside the soil to allow their shape, there's immense power in that.
Well, it is. And, of course, most of the carrots that we eat are sort of, long and thin. But, in fact, there's a round carrot, which the French have selected. So it's only, almost smaller than a small beetroot.
So that's a really tough soil that grows in?
Yes. That's one of its attractions, that you don't put carrots into clay soil because you really want soft roots. And so you want sandy soils. And, gardeners find that out pretty early. But in fact, I could show you a carrot that's 2 feet long, which the Japanese have selected out. But most of them either are the conventional ones we see in the markets today, or perhaps thicker and more pointy. So there's lots of different shapes, and there's four or five colours. And everyone's sort of trying to get the most tender variety that works in sandy soils.
Those ancient Afghan carrots, the purple variety that you mentioned is the beginning of this tale. What sort of soils were they in, and how did they adapt?
Nearly everyone wants sandy soils. As I found out, we had Maggie Beer for lunch one day.
As you do.
As she was launching a book, and I served her up our Afghan carrot. Now, in November, they run up to seed, so all carrots get very woody at that time. Anyway, she was very polite. I was watching her while she was eating this because she'd never had it before, and she didn't say anything untoward, but she had two goes at it and was very polite about it. So the primitive ones, of course, are still got those characteristics which mostly we've bred out in the modern forms that we grow and eat.
Clive Blasey. You've been listening to Lost and Found on Blueprint for Living, this week on Earth. You heard from Wayne Crothers, Senior Curator of Asian Art at the National Gallery Victoria, Professor Stefan Mattei, Chair of Reservoir Engineering in the Department of Infrastructure Engineering at the University of Melbourne, Clive Blasey, founder of the Diggers Club, and Richard Thomas, Managing Director from Worm Lovers. Producers are Mira Adler-Gillies and Buffy Gorilla. Technical production by Brendan O'Neill. I'm Jonathan Green.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.